Hello, this is The Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, and today we're speaking with Dorka Tamás, a researcher working on poetry in the 20th century, a co-founder of the Sylvia Plath Society, a lady who knows a lot about the great Sylvia Plath. Dorka, it's a pleasure to have you on to talk about Sylvia Plath and the supernatural.
Thank you for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here.
The first thing to talk about is, who is Sylvia Plath? I'd love to get your take on who she was, what was her life, what did she do, what was her writing?
Yeah, so Plath was a mid-20th century poet, writer, mostly poet, because she only published one novel in her lifetime. I mean, she published also short fiction, but poetry was her main thing. She was born just after, like, or during the Great Depression era in Massachusetts. And she had parents that had European heritages, Austrian from her mother's side and German from her father's side. And Plath was really an excellent student and got a scholarship to study at Smith College. Then she came to England in 1956 and got a scholarship to study at the University of Cambridge. That's where she met Ted Hughes, a poet who was her husband. And the couple shared a love and interest towards poetry and writing and some aspects of the supernatural, folk stories, myths, that really made a connection between them two, a creative connection. And they moved back to America for a couple of years, but then they relocated to England in 1960. That year, first poetry book, The Colossus, and other poems were published. And they lived in London for about a year, and then they moved to Devon, the small village of North Houghton.
Yay!
Where they bought a cottage, and that's where their second child, Nicholas, was born. The firstborn was Frida, who she was born in London. And during that period of time, that's when Plath wrote the majority of The Bell Jar and edited it.
Which is her novel.
The Bell Jar is her only published novel. And 1962 was when their marriage started to break down. Ted Hughes left her, and she was living in Devon in that cottage with the two children. And that was the period of time in very socially isolated time of her life that she wrote the best poems of her life, that she said that will make her name, that were published posthumously in Ariel. And then she moved out with the children to London during the winter of 1962 and 63, and she died by suicide in February 1963.
What happened to the children?
The children were in the flat when Plath committed suicide. They were taken after by Ted Hughes, and Ted Hughes was the primary caregiver. They moved to the Devon cottage, and I believe they lived most of their childhood in the Devon cottage.
Right.
And the Devon cottage is still where Ted Hughes's widow lives.
In North Taunton.
Yes.
The Devon connection is one of the reasons I couldn't resist inviting you to talk about Sylvia Plath on the podcast, because, North Taunton is just around the corner from here. Okay, so she had a very short life.
She died at the age of 30.
Right. And
younger than me.
This wasn't the first time, as sort of talked about in her poem Lady Lazarus, which you find in Ariel.
Yes.
This isn't like the first time she tried to kill herself. It also appears sort of in fictionalized form in The Bell Jar, if I recall.
Right? Yes, yeah. The Bell Jar retells the story of the summer of 1953 when she took a guest editorship in New York at a women's fashion magazine and got really disillusioned with the whole city and society. And she was also rejected from a Howard writer's course. And all of that experience made her fall into a deep depression that resulted with a suicide attempt that she recovered from later.
Mm. And being put through the ringer of electroshock therapy, and
yes,
which I guess was meant to be for her own good, but seems to have been an experience of hellish torture from how she describes it.
Yes. Unfortunately, her first experience of electroshock therapy was botched. So they didn't... I can't remember the details, but they didn't do it properly the way in which... I don't know the medical terms, but the way in which an electroshock therapy is supposed to go, I think it's supposed to be under anesthetics. And she wasn't given anything, so she was conscious the whole time of receiving that. And it really created an awful experience for her towards as well medical professionals and medical institutions, psychiatry, that later in her writings, like Lady Lazarus, the poem, in my opinion, she linked it with the way in which witches were tortured during the early modern witch trials.
Mm. That might be a time where we want to cut and listen to Sylvia Plath's, a recording of Sylvia Plath, which she did, I think, for the BBC. I'm not 100% sure about
this.
Yeah. Yes. Reading Lady Lazarus. You can hear her sonorous Massachusetts accent, but you can also just get a picture of this extraordinary poem. So again, written late in her life, not long before her suicide, when she's living in Devon, reflecting on previous suicide attempts.
Lady Lazarus, I have done it again. 1 year in every 10 I manage it, a sort of walking miracle. My skin bright as a Nazi lampshade, my right foot a paperweight, my face a featureless fine Jew linen. Peel off the napkin, oh my enemy. Do I terrify? Yes, yes, Herr Professor, it is I. Can you deny the nose, the eye pits, the full set of teeth? The sour breath will vanish in a day. Soon, soon the flesh the grave cave ate will be at home on me, and I a smiling woman. I'm only 30, and like the cat, I have 9 times to die. This is number 3. What a trash to annihilate each decade. What a million filaments. The peanut-crunching crowd shoves in to see them unwrap me hand and foot, the big strip tease. Gentlemen, ladies, these are my hands, my knees. I may be skin and bone, I may be Japanese. Nevertheless, I am the same identical woman. The first time it happened, I was 10. It was an accident. The second time I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell. They had to call and call and pick the worms off me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art, like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. I guess you could say I've a call. It's easy enough to do it in a cell. It's easy enough to do it and stay put. It's the theatrical comeback in broad day to the same place, the same face, the same brute, amused shout, a miracle that knocks me out. There is a charge for the eyeing of my scars. There is a charge for the hearing of my heart. It really goes. And there is a charge, a very large charge, for a word or a touch or a bit of blood or a piece of my hair or my clothes. So, so, Herr Doctor, so, Herr Enemy, I am your opus, I am your valuable, the pure gold baby that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. Do not think I underestimate your great concern. Ash, ash, you poke and stir, flesh, bone. There is nothing there, a cake of soap, a wedding ring, a gold filling. Hear God, hear Lucifer, beware, beware. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air.
Now let's talk about Sylvia Plath and the supernatural, something you have written a book on by that very title, which just came out, and witches come into it. But one of the things that you didn't emphasize very much that my instincts want to emphasize is this, as a way of leading, sort of creating a continuity, maybe. she's reading, she's coming up in the 40s and 50s. She's reading the modernists a lot. She's reading Joyce. She's reading Yeats. In fact, it blew my mind that when they moved to London, they found Yeats's family home and actually moved in there.
No. So that was when Platt lived alone, when she, after her separation from Hughes, she had a plan to move to London again. And she was lucky enough to find a flat in the same square or the same area where they lived, in Primrose Hill before, which an area she really loved. And turned out it was the same flat that W.B. Yeats lived. And Platt saw that this is really, this is the great mystical connection here.
Right.
And before as well, she was debating whether she should move to London. And they did, she did a little practice of bibliomancy with Yeats's collected works. And where her fingers landed was a sentence that was about basically moving and moving on and going to the house. And she thought that this is the sign that I need to be in Yeats's house and move to London.
And she made it happen, which is amazing.
Yes.
So there's that connection where we're in a new generation of poetry. I don't know if anyone's given a name to it. It's probably better that we don't bother with that sort of thing. But looking back to the modernists at what they were doing, trying to develop something new, moving into the sort of post-war 20th century. And one of the things we know about the modernists, and especially Yeats, is that they were occultists, or Yeats was certainly an occultist. And so that's a kind of one, I think, must be one of the ingredients in her worldview as she engages with the supernatural.
Yes, when interestingly, when she met with Ted Hughes in Cambridge, she was obsessed with this idea that Hughes and her are going to be like Mr. and Mrs. Yeats, and they're going to write poetry and read tarot cards and do astrology. So even early on, she felt this poetic and almost like an identity connection towards Yeats and the mystical side of poetry writing.
Mm. That's my contribution to, or my steering of the conversation toward what I'm interested in. But what are some of the things that you think are important to talk about vis-a-vis Plath's poetry and her engagement with what you call the supernatural in your book?
Yes. Yeah. So I use this umbrella term supernatural because I think it gives some leverage to talk about the various stuff that fall under the supernatural. I didn't want to use the word occult because I think it's a loaded term. And there's another book that has been published called Occult Sylvia Plath that's focused more on the mystical side and her relationship towards alleged things that she was interested in. And so this is also my PhD title, so it's already appeared in my PhD, and I really like the title. You know, when you're trying to title a book, you browse the internet whether something similar exists, and it didn't, so I just like the title as well.
Yeah.
I liked it because one aspect of my work that I talk about is in the book is about the early modern witch hunt and the kind of loaded terms and conceptual framework of that, with like the witch figure, the wizard, the magician, demons and the devil. So a lot of them coming from a Christian understanding of supernatural creatures. And the other thing where I think Plath is really important in terms of talking about the supernatural is the understanding of poetry as spell work.
Mm. So vis-a-vis the first thing, the witch hunts, I mean, the
yes.
She is not the only person from the U.S. or observing the U.S. in the 1950s to compare what was going on with the McCarthy trials for un-American activities with a witch hunt. I mean, it was the classic political witch hunt in many ways, you know, America's version of the Stalinist show trials of the 1930s in a certain way. Not as brutal, but still pretty nasty. What else does she do with the figure of the witch, though? I mean, that's something she does with the figure of the witch. We see this both in her letters and in her poetry to some degree. There's this witch hunt going on. Okay. Yes. But what else does she, because she goes deeper with witches and witchiness.
Yeah. So in my understanding, or what I kind of discovered in my like while researching this topic, is that she understands the witch figure in many different ways and writes about conceptually or vocabulary wise differently about different witch figures. One is the kind of historical witch. I call the historical witch people who have been accused of, you know, committing witchcraft. That's the kind of witch figure, more metaphorical or more political one, that she uses as a metaphor for Cold War politics, for any kind of persecution of marginalized communities, and a kind of political terminology. Like, she really politicizes the witch. And the other ways in which she writes about witches is the literary heritages from even Macbeth's Weird Sisters and fairy tales, early modern plays, the way in which then the witch has a heritage of being associated with an evil maternal figure. Oftentimes somebody who controls, you know, in Macbeth, the Weird Sisters prophesies, but they also are a kind of haunting maternal force over Macbeth. And so she really combines a kind of weird sister, wicked witch figure to think about motherhood, or motherhood being evil, or mothers being evil.
Mm. Yeah, you get the impression that her family life was intense. She writes about her dad as well, and he's just, I don't know if I can say much about the specifics of what she's doing, but it's clearly there's some issues there. It's really intense, you know.
Yeah, I find it fascinating though that she uses the supernatural or these terminologies to talk about family relations and to find a ways to write about it and express even negative or ambiguous feelings that were not quite, I guess, acceptable, or you couldn't say it so directly. So I think she's finding a poetic or a literary way to untangle these complicated feelings.
Yeah. Do you think this relates to her feelings about being a mother as well as her own mother?
That's interesting. Somebody asked me this question as well before, whether the ways in which she writes about her own relationship to her mother, does that apply to her own motherhood? I don't think so. Okay. I think my understanding was or is that, like, I think it's quite common that people think that they're going to be different parents than their parents were. And, you know, there are different anecdotal evidences that what kind of a mother Platt was, but she really loved her children and she really wanted them to get a good education. One of the ways in which she has done it is she was writing about it in her letters, that she wanted her children to get religious education as well. And while she didn't believe in the church, or she wasn't part of the Church of England, that was only that option in that small Devon village. And even though the local rector was a kind of an interesting figure who was advocating for nuclear war and bombing.
Yeah, he was an apocalyptic Cold War sort of Jesus is coming back on a nuclear fireball type guy.
Yes, and but Platt still saw the kind of positive side of religion, and she even looked at religious prayers similarly to, like, magic spells.
Mm.
But, you know, there's that connection between prayers and spell work. And
yeah, it's forever bedeviling historians who want to look at either religion or magic, because it turns out that you can't really make a hard division between what a prayer is trying to do and what a magical spell is trying to do. Most of the time, there's always going to be some overlap. So the figure of the witch, does she identify with the witch in any way in her use of the witch image?
Just going back to that rector and religion, I that's my favorite anecdote from, like, Platt's archives, is during the time in which she was separating from Hughes, the rector went to visit Platt in her house, I think, to talk about the separation. And Platt really disapproved. The rector didn't like him. And she told her friend, her neighbor, that she chased this religious figure out from her house like a witch with her broom. So there's an interesting dynamic between this clergy, a religious figure, and an identification with the witch figure with her broom, and as an antagonist of, like, religion. I think there are other parts in her journals, something I didn't really touch on in my book, was the kind of idea of the sexual witch, or like a woman who is bewitching men. And she was very much aware of that kind of vocabulary that was used in advertisements as well, and, you know, something that goes back to classics and Medea and Circe being a kind of seducer type of goddess witch figures.
You touched on poetry as some kind of spell casting, some kind of magical act. And this will make sense in lots of different registers to people. What is Plath's particular take on this? Like, in how does she see poetry? How does she see what she does and its relation to magic?
There are no explicit writings on it, so this is my understanding based on my research and reading her letters and journals and her work. But Ted Hughes wrote about it later in his lifetime in a letter in which he made a connection between the act of creative writing, or an act of writing a poetry, and making a spell, or like creating magic. He understood it as magic, and that seemed to be a very similar way in which Platt understood writing, especially writing poetry, as it is a magical act of creation and doing something with words. And she was very much aware the way in which the language of magic operates, and, you know, with like repetitions and speech acts and rhythms and rhymes and a kind of ritualistic acts in both language, but something that you also have to do.
You just end up thinking a lot. I don't know if you think of this a lot, but I just think, like, God, if she'd lived past 30, if she'd lived to be, you know, like, what would she have contributed to the notions of literature and magic and where they meet up? But unfortunately, she could not take this world.
Yeah, I really like, especially that's, you know, more apparent in some of her later works, like in Ariel, the way in which Daddy, the most famous poem, I think one of Platt's most famous poems, that I also talk about in my book. And I'm trying to do a kind of supernatural reading of this very politically loaded poem. I look at drafts of the poem and the ways in which the repeated do in the poem with Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm true, and Daddy, you do not do, you do not do, and the act of doing, and who's doing what. And that's something that also appears in Macbeth with the Macbeth switches, and I do, I do, I do. And using the kind of rhythmical speech pattern, and that's something that previous critics really try to, you know, some people called it a chant, some people called it a kind of nursery rhyme-like spell casting, some people called it a kind of diabolical imagery or poem with politically loaded imagery. So it's definitely a poem that has been understood throughout, I think, scholarship, that having some kind of magical power, whether that's good or bad.
Incantatory.
Incantation, yeah.
Daddy, you do not do, you do not do, any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or hachu. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time, marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one gray toe big as a Frisco seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic, where it pours bean green over blue in the waters off beautiful Nauset. I used to pray to recover you, ach du, in the German tongue in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common. My Polack friend says there are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It's stuck in a barbed wire snare. Ich, 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 ich. I could hardly speak. I thought every German was you. And the language obscene, an engine, chuffing me off like a Jew. A Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck, and my tarok pack and my tarok pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you, with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo, and your neat mustache and your Aryan eye, bright blue. Panzerman, Panzerman, oh you, not God but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face, the brute, brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot. But no less a devil for that, no, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20 I tried to die and get back, back, back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw, and I said, I do, I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root, the voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year, 7 years if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through.
You can see why people have read this poem in a million different ways. On the one hand, she's living fully in the post-war American, like, Freudian worldview. That's what she's kind of grown up
yes.
into, right? Yes. So the notion of daddy issues and the notion of this sort of, like, weird conflict relations with your parents is something that's just seen as kind of, like, part of the human experience. That will be informing what she's thinking, I guess, when she writes this. But there's also this sort of theological stuff that comes in. And you don't know whether to read it as falling into the trap of trying to find the author's intentions, which is always a fraught and perilous thing to do. But is she reading this in a psychological register? Is she reading it in a theological register or both at the same time? And where is the kind of mythic in all of this as well? Because in all the folktales and myths that she's really quite into, there's a lot of evil dads and evil mothers and evil stepmothers and children having to go off on their own and all kinds of, you know, these really strong family yes. themes that she's very hip to. One other thing I wanted to ask you about is the significance of the bees, the bee poems. So for a bit of background, her dad was a beekeeper, right? He was a naturalist.
Beekeeper and, yes,
he wrote
biologist,
a... Yeah, he wrote a book on the bumblebee, and which was this very yes. kind of influential classic scientific text study of bumblebees. But he's a beekeeper. And when she settles down in North Taunton, she says, I'm going to get some hives. Let's do some beekeeping. She wrote a bunch of poems that end up in the posthumous volume Ariel that have to do with beekeeping. What's she doing with the bees?
What was she doing with the bees?
Yeah, vis-a-vis the supernatural, I guess you could say.
Yes. So, you know, Platt settled in that Devon cottage and she kind of fully adopted this, almost like a cloak, putting on herself that I'm going to be now a villager and I'm going to do all this like beekeeping and growing vegetables and fruits and taking care of the cottage. And so I think one way in which she immersed herself in that kind of countryside lifestyle is to adopt these practices of reproductive work of your own producing things. And the bees are really symbolic for her because of her father's profession. It appears in a couple of her previous works as well. In one poem, that was a villanelle called Lament. In that earlier poem, the bees are taking her father away, and it is an evil. The bees are evil in that poem. The bees stank the father, and they cause his death in that poem.
Whoa.
And my other understanding, what I was working with in my book, which I thought it might have been a little bit of a contentious or controversial take, is that her bees in the bee poems are described very similarly to witches as well. They're all women. They are women partaking in a hive. They're flying. And they also have supernatural powers, the witches, like witches in the bees. So especially in the draft of these bee poems, there are a couple of descriptions that the queen bee is a devil. And it's almost like a witch cult influenced by Margaret Murray's witch cult in Western Europe. Classic hypothesis. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't hold much credence among scholars nowadays, among historians, but was very influential at its time. I think actually Murray is maybe one of the, perhaps the work has been done on this, but the degree to which she influenced the, what are just background assumptions of modern sort of neo-pagans, for lack of a better term, is huge, right? Like people just take it. There's a lot of people who take it for granted that there was this secret witch cult of women in Christian, that there was a hegemonic Christian discourse in Western Europe, and the witch cult kind of was the subterranean female positive pagan holdover of a pre-Christian past, and that's just taken as that's exactly how it was.
And early on in her life, when Platt was around 20-22, that's when she read The Golden Bough first. She read only their first volume, and she really started identifying herself as pagan,
right?
And she wrote about herself as a pagan girl and this kind of nature loving, very sentimental ideas about paganism and greenness.
Fraser's another guy who just has put an indelible mark on the 20th century and the 21st century. Cannot overstate the importance of The Golden Bough, as we've discussed in an episode devoted to his work. So Dorka, what do we need to talk about in Sylvia Plath and the Supernatural that we haven't talked about?
I was really fascinated by the drafts of her writing and the ways in which authors or writers, poets, censor themselves in terms of supernatural, and the ways in which she was much more explicit in her drafts using language or allusions, references that are about either devils and diabolism, or, you know, rhythmical speech patterns, or writing about spirit words and all kinds of, you know, Joan of Arc as a martyr figure, all of that that didn't make it in the end in the finished product. And I was really fascinated by this idea of why poets or writers would like to erase that part in their works, and how, in what ways does, you know, the supernatural then function as a way, as a creative inspiration that you start with.
Yeah, that's a really maybe a classic example of the phenomenon whereby, you know, when people discuss Western esotericism, it's often with a very modern perspective. And
yes,
it's tempting to describe it as forbidden knowledge or rejected knowledge. This is a very common model of this. Western esotericism, Western esoteric ideas are rejected knowledge. Look at, and then you can see someone like Sylvia Plath. She's coming from inspiration, drawing on not just strictly Western esotericism, even though she is doing Ouija board, homemade Ouija board with her husband, and she's doing bibliomancy. She's doing lots of cool mantic practices that could be seen as esoteric practices. She's interested in the more
reading tarot cards.
Yeah, interested in the witches in Macbeth rather than, you know, interested in, yes, the really esoteric bits of Shakespeare, like Prospero and the witches.
Yes,
that you want to kind of edit that out from her legacy, if you're going to, say, recoup her as a modern feminist or a modern female poet. We don't want any of that baggage. And so her self-editing that stuff out of her own work can be seen as a form of self-censorship in order to conform with that modern way of writing, way of thinking that rejects all that stuff. Now, if you take the same approach to a lot of those materials from a non-modern ocentric perspective, this is all just quite mainstream. In that, for example, in the Middle Ages, this is all, none of this is esoteric at all, or at least it's certainly not rejected knowledge. It's knowledge. I mean, people do bibliomancy, people do read the tarot cards, and the universe is full of correspondences. And indeed, poets can be powerful magicians, right? In many cultures, in many times, many places. But in specifically that post-war American context, and maybe part of why she found Devon, found like the romantic moving to Devon and living as a cottager appealing, is because it can be seen very much or experienced very much as a escape from that Cold War technocratic, you know, nuclear war mindset that she grew up in.
Yeah, and
so
I like
upset
that.
With.
Yeah, and there were these news reportings even in the early 60s that there are white and black witches in Devon. And so even at the time, Devon and Cornwall were seen as this pagan, magical, witchy place. And there are some description in archives of Plath doing these works around the cottage. And so she was painting for her baby, the child's crib, and according to like description, it was like flower patterns in Austrian style, which is, I'm from Hungary, so I know the kind of pattern that they are talking about. And that was something in connection with like the bees and how she attributed as well magical powers to these patterns and paintings, and like kind of, maybe like a protective spell. I'm not quite sure, but she was partaking in these creative ways to practice, I guess. That's something I've been also interested in the book, in the project, the blurred lines between magic or like ritualistic practices and, you know, mundane rituals, and what we attribute to magical intent. And she attributed magical intent to a lot of things, I think. In terms of what you were talking about, the Cold War context and like Plath going back to these mystical, supernatural things, I think what's interesting is that a lot of these are very in right now and very trendy, like occult poetry. And so the ways in which people, a lot of people like reading Plath or this kind of supernatural, mystical reading, it seemed to be coming back. So at least I hope to contribute to that. So I think she would have been probably really interested in the kind of contemporary occult poetry writing scene.
She probably would have also been really interested to see how neo-paganism, witchiness,
yes,
that sort of aesthetic has become perhaps more popular as a religion in the West Country than Christianity, at least among younger generations. I mean, speaking anecdotally, I know a lot more vaguely pagan spiritual people who often identify as witches than I do Christians who actually go to church.
Yeah, I think it's would have been very interesting to see like her development of ideas, or even with second wave feminism and Diane Quicker, kind of a female centered, goddess centered, neo pagan movement, and whether she how would she have felt about it? I'm really curious.
We won't know though. Sadly, no. She was taken from us, or took herself from us, very tragically young. Yeah. Dorka Tamás, thank you so much for coming on and talking about the supernatural in the
thank you.
Life and poetry of Sylvia Plath.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Stay esoteric.